from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I should say right up front here, this may not be an easy show to listen to for some of you, but I'm hoping you'll give it a shot anyway. If you're one of those people who want to jump out a window or beat your head against a wall when you hear a teenager in conversation, John McWhorter is not exactly telling you to lighten up, but he is, kind of. McWhorter is a linguist, a popular writer, and in his latest book, he's trying to get people to shed their sense of acrid disgust when they hear language they think is bad. Because language, he says, isn't bad. It just is. It's changing constantly. It doesn't stand still. It's a parade, he says. It's a film, not a photo. McWhorter is joining us today to make his case and to try to get you to replace that disgust with wonder. Do you think you can? Join us after the news.
Hey, Radio West listener. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. John McWhorter does not think, I repeat, does not think we should do away with the rules of grammar or any of the other rules about words and sentence structure, but he does want us to give up our sense of disdain and disgust when we hear the words that drive us nuts, like nuclear, like, used by a teenager, like literally when a person means figuratively. McWhorter's a linguist. He's written a lot of books about language, and in his latest, he's making this case for understanding rather than tearing your hair out. Language is not some fixed thing. Language shifts and moves. It changes, and not because we want it to or don't want it to. McWhorter says it changes because that's its nature. And hating on a word like literally, he says in the book, is like daring a lava lamp not to let its clump drift into configurations we think are improper. Language, he says, is just going to clump, and we need to learn to understand it and maybe along the way give people a break. His new book is Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still, like literally. And he's joining us today to talk about it. John McWhorter is an associate professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. He's the author of 16 books. I mentioned the latest. He's joining us from a studio at Columbia University in New York City today. John McWhorter, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
I guess I wanted to begin with having you explain what the book is about. Because right up front, you make it clear that it's not one of these books that's about grammar rules or this ongoing debate about grammatical points. You're trying to get at something else. But explain what you're trying to get at.
Well, what I mean is that I think that the way we can't help hearing language is not consonant with what language is actually like. And I make an analogy in the book between the way even most of the educated populace in America hears language and the way people saw flora and fauna before we understood how natural selection worked. In that, I think we have a sense that there's something you would call the real language, and we associate it with the page and the written word, and we think that's what the language is. And then we hear all these departures from it, and we think that the departures from what the language supposedly is are either wrong or they're quaint. They demand some kind of explanation because really there's this sacrosanct one language. Now, what I mean by saying that there is no one language is not a sociological point.
Yeah.
So my point is not we have to accept different ways of speaking because we have to accept different kinds of people. It's not coming from any kind of politics of my own. This is the science of language, which is very simple. It's inherent to language to change in the same way as, this is the analogy that I use in the book, clouds change in the sky. If the clouds were in the same place tomorrow as they are now, you'd think something had gone wrong. The wind is always moving clouds around. With language, it's the exact same thing, except the wind is that we all hear words in slightly different ways, their meanings buzzing around a word in our heads. We hear a sound a little differently than the person produces it, and so we produce the sound differently. Take that over generations, and all language is always changing, just like that clump in the lava lamp.
Right.
So that's what Words on the Move is about. It's not get over language change because teenagers are cool.
Right.
It's that we have to understand that any language that we hear is just one stage along this endless procession of morphing. And I think we can come to enjoy it in the way that linguists do if we linguists would just share it with the public more the way it actually is. So that's what I'm trying to do with Words on the Move.
Just a quick aside on grammar, although we'll come back to this because you write about where basically where grammar comes from. But what do linguists make of grammar? I mean, you say linguists often see these rules as kind of arbitrary and sometimes unconnected to clarity or logic. Even though you don't say ditch grammar, I mean, obviously that's another part of the natural process. But how do you see grammar?
Well, any language, and there are 6,000 or depending on how you count it, 7,000 languages, any language has structure. Yeah. You can't just know the words. You have to know how to put them together. And knowing how to put the words together in any language is a complicated business. Now, what we're taught grammar is a collection of things that we tend to do naturally, but we're told are wrong. And so grammar is taught as this series of mistakes not to make. Now, the truth really is, and linguists have been saying this forever, and I sense that it makes no impression on the general public, and so I've given it up.
Yeah.
Those rules are all things that were made up mostly by some people 300 and 400 years ago who didn't know as much about the languages of the world and how different languages are from one another, and mostly had a sense that English was supposed to be like Latin because Latin was classical and written down and wonderful, and English at this point was still an upstart language that was just taking its place on the world stage. Now, that is simply a fact. However, it's also true that today a linguist can't say, don't pay any attention to those things, and always say Billy and me went to the store, even though the idea that you're supposed to say Billy and I went to the store, and this is something people have a hard time believing, it's not based on any kind of linguistic logic, no matter what you think about subjects and objects. It's something somebody just happened to make up, and it happened to end up catching on. But we can't ignore those things because there will always be fashions. It's just like fashions make no sense. Why are you wearing these clothes this decade and then the next decade different clothes and hairstyles? We can't get away from it. So anybody needs to be taught those no-no grammatical rules. But we need to be able to hear people speaking in their natural way, not as making mistakes, but just as being formal. It's the difference between the T-shirt and the tuxedo.
Right. Why do you think we react so emotionally, get so angry? I mean, one of the things you get at later in the book is that in some ways, this reaction, this violent reaction at times, is kind of tribal. There's a kind of tribalism going on.
Yeah, there is. I think that it's partly that we see language on the page and it looks so tidy and it's permanent. It outlasts us. And so we sense that's what the language is supposed to be. Then you're taught by people in school at an age when you're impressionable, your teachers are intelligent, they have authority. You're taught that's the way it's supposed to be. So then you hear these departures and it's impossible not to hear these things as somehow off. Even me. Because, you know, on my better days, I'm a human being. Despite what I know intellectually about how language works, of course, there are things that I don't like hearing because I think that's just not the way it's supposed to be. But that's just based on my having grown up in a culture that's on writing, as I put it. But then also, there really is a disproportionate anger. You know, somebody writes less books instead of fewer books. And
right.
somebody writes into a comment section as if the person had called for taking money from the poor. I think that a lot of the anger is because, especially we, what we might call enlightened folk, there are a lot of things that we have learned we can't and shouldn't say when it comes to tribalism. And so we're trying to get past sexism. We're trying to get past racism. You don't have those things. And, of course, those we're far from perfect on those things, but it is a very different world than it was 50 years ago. And so in a way, if there's an extent to which human beings need to feel a certain tribalist impulse and to, frankly, look down on others. One way you can still do it politely is to diss people about their language. You can fulminate about that the way somebody 100 years ago could fulminate about, quote unquote, the Negroes.
Yeah.
And I think that that is part of why this topic can sometimes make people angry, as I've experienced as a linguist. You're really stepping on something.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that is something I mentioned in the book.
You say Samuel Johnson, when he was putting together his dictionary, He had this kind of naive idea that if you codified language, it would stop shifting. But that's not how it works. Let me put this question to you as you raise it in the book. Let's say we have a community of people who, for some reason or another, have been totally isolated on an island, you say in a cave, for thousands of years, like not exposed to the outside world, no connection whatsoever with any sort of outside influence. Would their language change?
And that's exactly it. It would change profoundly.
Yeah.
The way I put it is that if you put those people in the cave and somehow those people could survive for 3,000 years, when they came out 3,000 years later, they'd be speaking a different language than they were speaking when they went in, despite that no new things were invented. They didn't have contact with other people. Because I think we all understand that language is going to change in that you need new words for new things.
Yeah.
I think everybody understands that our slang isn't going to be the same as the slang of 1920. Go beyond that, though, and people seem to start getting uncomfortable. But that's because it's not clear how changeable language is. It's funny. I didn't put that little analogy on an island because I wanted the people to seem as utterly cut off from anything as possible. If you put them on the island, then people think, well, you know, there's God in the sky or the changing weather or something that's going to make them change their language. Got to put them in that cave. It's dark. And yet still, when they came out, they would not have been able to speak with the people who went in 3,000 years before.
Language changes, you say, because its structure makes it inevitable. Transformation happens. So give us a sense of, I mean, we'll break this down as we go, but in a general sense, how is it that transformation is inevitable in language?
Like the game of telephone.
Yeah.
That's exactly how language is passed down. And so every generation, every person is going to produce sounds a little differently than the way they heard them. Vowels in particular are like bees in a hive always moving around. So what's O in one generation is going to be something like maybe oh, in another generation. Next generation, that'll be ah. Next generation, that'll be ah. Now, all of that happened much faster than it happens, but that is what happens to every vowel in any language at any time. And you can't stop that process. There's nothing that can hold it down. And then there's the meaning of words. And so you can have a word, something I describe in the book, you can have a word that means blessed. And then 100 years later, blessed means something along the lines of innocent, because people who are blessed are often innocent. But if you're innocent, then it kind of implies that you're weak. And so for you know, generations, about five generations later, that word that meant blessed means weak.
Yeah.
But if you're weak, then you might be mentally weak, you might be kind of dumb, and if you're dumb, you might be kind of silly. And that meant that a word in English that meant blessed came to mean silly. Our word silly started out as salik, which meant blessed. And that's what happens to any word. So take the vowels and take what I just described happening not just to the occasional weird word, but to most words. And you can see how any language is always something going on rather than something that is.
Use the word adorable, which is like the original understanding is the granting of adoration. It's adorable. How did that word morph and become now, oh, that's adorable, it's cute, it's charming?
Right. It's one of the many pathways that a word might take when it changes. You adore the Empire State Building. You adore Citizen Kane. But the Empire State Building is not adorable. Citizen Kane is not adorable. And that's because adorable's meaning changed from being simply that which you adore to something more specific. It became about things that are small and kind of dear. And you never know which direction a word might take, but it's going to take a direction that's plausible as one step from where it was. It's cute to talk about adoring something that's small and dear. It kind of sticks. It's a neat way of using that word adore. And gradually that became what adorable meant. And so no one could have predicted that when the word adore in that meaning first appeared. And yet here we are. And that sort of thing happens all the time. I can't stress more. I'm not describing things that happen to an interesting little collection of words. The words that don't change, like and or brother or I, those are the exceptions. Most words are always just moving along.
Before we get to a break, I want to have you make another point. This is interesting. You say that we aren't always, or at least we weren't in our history, always this judgmental about language. You say that it wasn't until like the 18th century. Then I guess it was the emergence of the middle class that we started becoming grammar Nazis, I guess.
Yeah, this is kind of new. You'd think that the feelings that we have now were eternal, but no, actually there was a great diversity of Englishes before, and people just accepted that as the way it was. If you went over to the next village, you couldn't understand them, but the idea wasn't that they spoke wrong, it was just that they were different. The idea that there's one way to speak and that everybody else is doing it either quaintly or wrong starts especially with the emergence of a self-conscious bourgeoisie and a concurrent sense that they needed to have a language that had a world presence and had status and was codified. And I don't mean by that simply that they were snobs. All of this was very ordinary. Yeah. This happened in a lot of nations. But as a result, we had this feeling that most of us feel like we don't quite speak as well as we would like. Nobody in England in 1350 would have known what that meant.
Is there any going back? Like going back to that, I mean, this is something we'll come back to a little bit later, but like that sense of wonder or interest about something different rather than disgust or disdain, like are you hopeful that we can go back to being less judgmental about that?
I think that we really could if a book like mine got around more, or this sounds so self-serving, but if the things that are in my book were in general school curricula such that one generation would not grow up thinking of language as something that they do wrong. This idea, this version of things that I'm putting forth in Words on the Move, which is really what any linguist would believe, if everyone knew, I think that we would see an America where we process language in a different way. Now, whether it can be that way, since I only wrote one book and my book competes with so many others, I don't know. But you know, the concepts aren't hard. It's just that these things aren't shared. That's what I'm trying to do with this book.
John McWhorter is with us. His book is Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still, like literally. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us John McWhorter, who is talking about his new book, Words on the Move. He has a podcast, too, with Slate.com about language. It's called Lexicon Valley. He's joining us from a studio at Columbia University. He's an associate professor of English and comparative literature there. I wanted to ask you about I want to get to some of the basics, because you say there are five ways that language changes. And I wanted to start with I really liked this idea. The idea that change is personal. Words start out showing what they mean, but over time, there's this personal pull.
Yeah.
And they end up not being about what they mean, but how we feel they mean. Take us through this idea.
Yeah, it's that a lot of words don't mean something in the way that we think a word in a language is supposed to have meaning. A lot of words are tools. They don't mean something. They do something. And what they're doing is they're exploring how other people feel about what we're saying, or they're making a guess, or they're giving what our attitude towards something is rather than stating what it is that we're talking about. So a good example of that is totally. And the whole point of this is that this is one of the ways that a word's meaning can change. It's very common. Totally. If somebody says, oh, we're totally going to get tickets, that doesn't mean we are really going to get tickets. Those are two different sentences. When somebody says, we're totally going to get tickets, it also doesn't mean we're going to get tickets in some entire fashion.
Yeah.
You know, what we're totally going to get tickets means is we are going to get tickets despite that some people might have reason to think that we're not. Maybe there's some slight obstacle to us getting tickets. Maybe we're going to get these tickets to something that many people would say we shouldn't want to see, like, you know, a Weird Al Yankovic concert or something like that. Oh, we're totally going to get tickets. Totally, in other words, indicates that you are acknowledging the state of mind of the other person and denying some potential contradiction. Mm. That sounds complicated, but it's pretty simple. It's that totally means that somebody else thinks this isn't true, but you and I know that it is. Now, we don't think of that consciously, but that means that totally, which 30 years ago meant entirely or really, has developed this new meaning that we use in conversation. We usually wouldn't use it in writing, although the headlines of many venues, such as actually Slate, are beginning to use these spoken forms and written headlines, which I think is great.
Yeah.
But these are things that we use in conversation. And so if you're going to say something like, John Bolton is totally going to be appointed to that post, that means that there are reasons to think that he wouldn't be, but you know what? We know that he is. There are lots and lots of words like that. One of them is LOL.
Yeah.
And so people say, LOL doesn't have a meaning. But it does. It doesn't have a meaning. It has a function. What it does is it eases. And so you stick LOL onto the end of things to indicate everything's okay. There's nothing tense. I like you. You like me. We do that in conversation with involuntary little chuckles and laughs. If you know somebody who never chuckles or laughs when they talk to you, they're either odd or you feel like they don't like you. And it's because it's part of conversation to do all that chuckling. LOL has made it so that you can do that in texting. Now, linguists call this sort of thing pragmatics.
Yeah.
That is a horrible, ambiguous piece of jargon, and so I only use it a little bit in the book. And instead, I call it our face markers, and I have a little acronym, F-A-C-E, and I give a type of these sorts of words that you have for F, A, C, and E. So, for example, totally is an acknowledgement marker. There are various acknowledgement markers that we have. Another one of them is stuff, mm-hmm. or something that you can imagine what I would rather say rather
right.
than stuff. And yeah. you think, well, it's just profanity. No, it means you know what else I mean. And so I went to the party and people were dancing and stuff,
yeah.
although imagine what I would really say. Well, when you say dancing and stuff, that conveys that we both know that also they had drinks in their hands, that maybe the dancing was a prelude to some sort of mating, etc. It ends up filling in what you know is in the other person's mind. That's an acknowledgement marker. Mm-hmm. So that's one of five things that can happen to a word. One of the five things is that it can go from meaning something to just doing something
yeah.
in terms of this face business.
Acknowledgement, that acknowledgement part of face, is one of those is you know.
Exactly.
And which I thought was fascinating. I love knowing that you hear you know, or at least a form of that, in Canterbury mm-hmm. Tales, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales.
Chaucer actually has it in there. The word is woost instead yeah. of know at
right.
that point.
Right.
But, you know, those are jolly characters doing jolly things. And she does a you know way back then, which shows you that it's not that language is falling apart. Language, casual language, is the same everywhere all the time, regardless of what the society is like. It can be harder to get a sense of casual language in the past because people were much less likely to write it down. That ends up creating an illusion that today people are sloppier about language than they were before, when really it's just that before, almost the only language that made it to the page was the formal kind. That wasn't the way people talked when they were chopping potatoes.
Another aspect of this face sort of schema that you write about is the factuality. It's the first one, right?
Yeah.
I guess it's a good time to talk about a word usage that drives a lot of people crazy. You see it on T-shirts, literally.
Mm-hmm.
Factuality is sort of fits in here. Explain how.
Yeah. Literally is a word that people use to intensify various things that they say, including figurative expressions. And so somebody will say, I was literally dying of thirst. And if they're telling you that, then you know that they did not die of thirst. That irritates some people because they think the word literally is supposed to mean by the letter, exactly. And instead, it's being used to intensify figurative things. But really, if you think about it, if there's a word literally that means by the letter, that means exactly, well, it's going to change because almost all words change. And a big, lumpy, formal word like literally is never immune to change. The only question is what's going to happen. Now, if it means exactly, then you just know that over time it's going to come to mean something that's a little bleached in comparison to exactly, but the same sort of thing. It's going to mean really. And once it means really, then it's going to be used for just about anything that you want to intensify, including figurative expressions.
Yeah.
Now, some people say, still, I cry foul because that means that literally can mean both itself and its opposite. But, you know, the truth is that any language has lots of words like that. We certainly do. Mm. They're called contronyms.
Yeah.
And so take fast. I sit fast. I am fast asleep. But then I run fast. Fast can mean itself and its opposite. You probably never thought about it. You just heard about it. You don't care. If anything, those things are really cool. And there's a list. There's several dozen contronyms. Literally joined that list. And from all that we can tell, it was hundreds of years ago. It's not something that people have been doing only lately. And I think that we should just enjoy that.
Right.
To speak English is to have some words that can mean themselves. It's delightfully wacky.
How long does it take? I'm not sure if you've done any studies about this. How long does it take for a word to, as it's going through that transformation between meaning one thing to meaning something completely different or very different, how long does it take for between the time when we are outraged by it, we're freaked out mm-hmm. by it, we're pissed off by it, to the when we just kind of accept it? Like, is there a kind of a natural order to that? And how long does that take?
You know, that's an interesting question. And there are certainly fashions, because it's only been so long that we've thought about these things like this at all.
Right.
There are fashions in which words attract that kind of attention. And I would definitely say that after a certain amount of time, even the most prickly people just accept that change has happened and they start complaining about the new things. I could sit here and give a guess and say something like 100 years. But I'd only be saying that because I know that the words that people complained about a lot in the 19th century were different than the ones that we complain about now. But for example, obnoxious used to mean standing out to be harmed, subject to harm. And people would complain that to use it to just mean annoying was a misanalysis of what it was supposed to mean. Well, now we don't even remember what that meaning originally was, and we've just accepted it. And instead, we're complaining about literally. And the fact is, if these things change, if these things end up being accepted, then the question arises as to why we were complaining in the first place.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you what there does not seem to be. There is no word where complaints like that have happened where the change, therefore, was stopped. There has actually been only one thing that pedants have said and insisted on so hard that you could actually say it's become a part of English grammar, even in a colloquial sense. And that's the business with Billy and I went to the store rather than Billy and me. That rule was just kind of made up,
right.
But it seems to evoke a certain affection, I think, because of the issue of subject and object. And so people tend to think that that really is the way it should be. And so that one really has become part of English. The pedants really have created something new. That's really the only example. Other than that, you just have people going on and doing what language does and being criticized and going to their graves feeling insecure. I think we could do better than that.
What do you understand about the difference between good and well as this fits? I had an email recently when somebody was griping about the response to when somebody says to you, "How are you?" And you say, "I'm good." Like, properly it's well, but it's sort of this – there's this general – seems like anyway that there's been this sort of general acceptance of the response, good, or how did you sleep, good, as opposed to well. I mean, where does that fit in all of this?
Well, the distinction between adjective and adverb is always hairy. It is more complicated in how English really works than we would have any reason to think. But – a good Germanic language, English is one of a, you know, passel of kittens, German is another one.
Right.
Good Germanic language often has this syncretism between adjectives and adverbs such that you don't need to add an ly in order to modify a verb. That's just the way the language has always been.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want English to be more like, say, Latin, then you have this sense that there are going to be adjectives and then there are going to be adverbs, and that you turn an adjective into an adverb by putting li on it because we kind of like endings and we think they're cool, and that therefore you can't go slow. You're supposed to go slowly. But English has been going slow forever. The idea that you have to have the li is based on a certain understandable sense people might have that you kind of want to keep your food separate on the plate, that you like things to be tidy. But it's not the way anyone has actually spoken. And as far as how are you doing and you say I'm good, where you're using an adjective to describe yourself just like you might say I'm tall,
yeah.
I think anybody can see the innocence in that. The idea that I am well because you use an adverb after a verb and am is a verb, when actually the idea that am is a verb is actually quite hairy in itself, or that it's somehow short for I'm doing well.
Yeah.
All of those are things that a person might artfully craft, but they're not how anybody ever naturally spoke and then people stopped doing it. So that's one of those things.
Yeah.
I'm well is something you might want to say in certain situations if you figure it'll irritate people if you don't. But for somebody to say I'm good isn't wrong. It's just the way English has always been. What was wrong with it?
Right.
That's the real answer to it.
Yeah.
But it does mean that you end up having to look at language without those judgmental glasses. And that's hard because we are told that certain things are the way it's supposed to be.
Explain uptalk. This fits into the sort of acknowledgement part of face.
Mm-hmm.
It's where a question... It's a question form used to convey a declaration. You hear it in certain young people, I guess. Maybe not so young people anymore. But this uptalk, how do you understand
yeah.
that?
Yeah, uptalk is a challenge. This is something that more and more Americans do. It's no longer something that only young women do.
Yeah.
And it's that when you're making statements, your voice goes up like this. So you'll say, so tomorrow we're going to go to Minnesota, but I forgot to bring my luggage, and so I decided I'm just going to have to send for it when we get there. A lot of people listen to that and they think, why does the person use question intonation when they're making statements? And it sounds like the person is being tentative or hesitant. But what it really is that the question intonation is only technically implying a question. It's not an actual question that the person is asking. What they're doing is making sure that the person who's talking is with them on the same page. The person is trying to get into their head. But really, they're making statements. And so it means that not only words can change, but even the meaning of an intonational pattern can change. And so da-da-da-da can mean a question, but it can also just mean you're with me, right, as somebody keeps on talking. But we hear it as something that does indicate questioning. And so it's a challenge. There are some fashions where we have to think about when and where we use language. I would tell somebody not to do too much uptalk if they're in a situation where they're trying to convince people of something or to be taken seriously. It's not fair, but it's nevertheless true, as many unfair things are, that uptalk sounds like a question. You don't sound firm when you're uptalking. However, for people to use uptalk all the time when they're speaking casually, I listen to it as a fascinating way that there's always a slip between what we think of as the vanilla meanings of things and what those meanings have become. And so, ba-ba-ba-ba used to only be for questions. Now, ba-ba-ba-ba also is just a friendly way of making a statement. It's interesting.
Counter expectation is another one of these face things. It conveys surprise. Let's see. I want to actually talk about ass because I think it's an interesting.
Are we allowed to?
So I think it's okay if we use the word ass on the radio because ass, as a counter expectation marker, I think is really interesting. Big ass pot, lame ass excuse. How does that fit?
Well, what it basically comes down to is if somebody looked out your window and said, oh, look, a gray ass squirrel, they don't just mean it's a gray squirrel. Nobody would say a gray ass squirrel just as a default statement. And it's not just that they're saying, look, it's a gray squirrel, but they're throwing a curse word in. Hey, look, it's a gray ass squirrel means that they would have expected the squirrel to be black or some other color. They mean, a gray squirrel counter to my expectation. So somebody might say, hey, look, a gray-ass squirrel, if they were from wherever. I know there are places where the squirrels are black. If they were from such a place, then to them the squirrel would not be just gray, but gray-ass. So that ass isn't just profane, and opinions will differ as to whether we call that profane,
right.
But it's also a marker of counter expectation that you use as part of your quote-unquote face. And so part of using language in a human way is to point out things that you wouldn't have expected before. That's part of why we open our mouth to say anything. And so there are always all sorts of ways that we indicate that something was counter-expectational other than saying, hey, I didn't expect that. So that ass of all things is that. So I've listened to that become especially popular. And I thought, isn't it nice how that really is becoming entrenched? Although I should say it goes back to the beginning of the 20th century at least.
Right, right. Here's a comment from Jim, who writes from Orem. He says, my primary complaint about changes in the language is that these changes sometimes rob us of beautiful words that sometimes don't have an adequate alternative or replacement. And he's referring to the word awesome. Jim says, awesome used to be reserved for experiences that might make you drop to your knees, but now they just mean neat or cool. So when I want to convey awesome, he says, in the way the word once used to, what word am I supposed to use now? What do you make of right. Jim's dilemma?
Well, yeah, the way I think of it is that words and their meanings are two different films. They're films that are on top of one another. And so the shapes of the words are always oozing around, and there's this grid of meanings underneath. And from period to period, the grid of words and the grid of meanings are differently aligned. And so, yeah, awesome used to be a castle. Now awesome is just the last movie that you saw. But I would say, really, if I'm trying to convey what somebody would have meant by awesome 500 years ago, 300 years ago, then I might say awe-inspiring. I might say tremendous. I might say that something was incredible. There are different ways of saying it, which may not be as entrenched and conventionalized as awesome mm-hmm. once was. But it isn't that words change meanings and somehow leave the other things impossible to express or only expressible through using three or four sentences. There are always other words that you can use.
I wanted to come back to this question of easing, the idea of in human speech, we want this constant reassurance. That's what LOL is. That's a form of easing.
Right.
But I'm really fascinated in how Black English fits in the idea of easing. Would you talk about that?
Well, I think a lot of people listen to Black people speaking and think, why can't they use proper grammar? Now, of course, there's a whole issue as to what proper grammar is, but I think it can be particularly confusing that you can hear that many Black people, frankly, all Black people, are capable of speaking standard English, but very often don't. Yeah. And so based on the linguistic regime that we live under, it's easy, it's even understandable to think, well, Black people are lazy linguistically because they keep on lapsing into this bad grammar. But what's really going on is that most Black people can speak in two ways. And there's no scientific basis for determining that the Black way is somehow lesser. And that's a whole other story. And actually, my next book, as a matter of fact.
Oh, great.
But when people do go into this other way of speaking, what they're doing it for is the easing. And so you use Black English in order to convey warmth, in order to convey group membership. It's something that most Black people do quite subconsciously. And it means that it's just part of a repertoire. So LOL is the easing that you use when you are texting. Just going in and out of Black English is the equivalent of LOL. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, President Obama can use Black English features, especially when he talks to Black audiences. And I've known some white people who very sincerely find that fake. Yeah. They're thinking, well, if he can speak perfect standard English, why would he ever do any of these y'alls and ain'ts and fiddle around with verb conjugations? But a Black person does that because you're easing. You're creating a sense of fellowship. Naturally, Barack Obama will do some of that when he's talking to the NAACP, as opposed to when he's making a State of the Union address.
Right. You write, this face part of English is what allows us to talk rather than speak. What's the difference?
Yeah. Well, speaking, and that's something I kind of made up for that passage, but by speaking, I mean that you are presenting yourself in a formal situation, often with a desire to convince. You're wearing a suit. Mm-hmm. Talking, though, is what you do most of the time. Most languages are only talked. if there's 6,000 languages, only about 200 of them are written in any real way, for example. And that means that 5,800 are ones that are only spoken, and their speakers find it odd to see them written down on the page. Language is mostly casual speech. And casual speech is so complex in itself that I hope we can develop a new way of hearing it as wonderful a thing as formal and written speech.
John McWhorter is with us. His book is Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still. He's joining us from a studio at Columbia University. He's an associate professor of English and comparative literature there. We'll take by the way, as a podcast, I should mention, for Slate.com, it's about language, of course. It's called Lexicon Valley. We'll put a link to it on our website. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the linguist John McWhorter. We're talking about his latest book, Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still, like literally. He's joining us from a studio at Columbia University in New York City. Nuclear. That's a word that drives people crazy, the pronunciation of it. but this sort of fits into this section in the book where you write about word sex, where, you know, words mating. And there's this kind of phenomenon where words mate and leave these chunks, this is how you put it, chunks of themselves inside of other words. And this sort of is how we get to nuclear. Explain.
Well, tubular, particular, oracular, we have those words in our head. Then there's this word nuclear. Now, if you think of nuclear as having to do with nukes on some level, then there's a part of your brain that wants to create patterns. It's the same thing that makes us feel like you're supposed to say Billy and I went to the store. It's the same thing that makes you feel like you're supposed to say slowly, or why it feels attractive to be told that you're supposed to put that Lee on there. Patterns. So the subconscious part of us thinks, well, oracular, tubular, well, then nuclear. It feels natural. And importantly, people who say nuclear when they're talking about nuclear things don't say nuclear family, where the whole notion of what's nukeable about the nuclear family is so abstract. Nuclear family, but nuclear matters, nuclear energy. Very natural. That's the way language always changes. It's things like that that get you from Old English to Middle English to Modern English. Hamburger started out as a hamburger steak, meaning the steak that you first learned how to make in the town, in the city of Hamburg. There's no such thing as a burger. It was the hamburger steak. Right. Now, of course, that gets shortened to let's have a hamburger, which meant let's have a hamburger. But because it had to do with meat, and you hear the ham, and even though it isn't made with ham, you don't have time to dwell on it, and it sounds vaguely plausible. Yeah. So you think hamburger. New word that made no sense whatsoever. Today we have veggie burger, fish burger. All of that is technically wrong, and yet here we are. Nuclear is the same thing. The fact that President Bush was so unpopular, I think, really did help nuclear attract a certain particular amount of venom. But, you know, apparently Dwight D. Eisenhower said nuclear, and he never attracted that kind of venom. It's very common among many educated people because it's a reinterpretation of the word. And yes, I openly admit I would never say it in public. If I heard my daughter say it, I'd find it a little odd because it's not a habit that's caught on with me or anybody that I know. But it's very common. And my not wanting my daughter to say it, I would feel guilty in feeling that way because it's exactly those kinds of changes that are why we're not speaking the language of the Canterbury Tales. And I don't think anybody thinks that that's a problem.
Your daughter calls a bathing suit a bathing soup.
Yeah, she used to. Yeah. She's gotten past that. But when I wrote the book, she was just getting out of that. And that's the thing. Are there mistakes? Definitely. If one person is saying something that other people aren't saying, then that qualifies as an error because it's not communal. But language changes communally. So it's not that everybody is walking around saying different sorts of things and seeking to understand one another. These changes catch on, and in a wave-like form, they go through the community until they've become default. But if my daughter says bathing soup, that's cute, but nobody else says bathing soup. Right. And if she kept on saying it, it would have made sense to correct her. Of course, she let that go by the time she was about three. But there are people who, for one reason or another, are saying something in their own particular way. That could qualify as a mistake. I knew somebody who, for no reason at all, you have to build randomness into any model of reality, for no reason at all, said grofery and nerfery instead of grocery and nursery. It was just a weird little blip in them that qualified as a mistake because nobody for any reason says grofery or nerfery. But most of the things that we're talking about aren't that this one person says it. It's that millions and millions of people are saying it. And if they are, what you're seeing always is how Latin became French. And to the extent that we don't wish that Latin had stayed the way it was, we can't imagine that our language would either.
This was interesting. You say that writing it down often casts this air of judgment over the way we speak. And you say it really does make language change more slowly than it otherwise would have. Do you have a sense of what's the time frame of language change? You say the change in English, for example, you say between Beowulf mm-hmm. and Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Was not typical. So how much will it change? How much? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Languages have different internal clocks on that, and that creates a great deal of controversy for various reasons, even in academic linguistic work. There's an Australian language that really did structurally turn upside down in just 100 years. It became a completely different grammar. Then on the other hand, there are languages where you can tell that the rate of change is much slower than that. But English is a tough one because on the one hand, before widespread writing and literacy, English had a couple of tsunamis. All of a sudden, you had all these Vikings from Scandinavia coming and learning the language wrong. It was imposed on all of these Celts, who were the original inhabitants of Britain, who ended up seasoning it with things from their own language. And so the English changed much faster between Beowulf and Shakespeare than a language normally does. Then, by the time we have Shakespeare, literacy is so widespread that everybody's brains are on writing, so to speak, and so everything slows down. The normal rate is somewhere in between. So Shakespeare, as I argue in the book, Shakespeare is not nearly as close to what we speak as we often like to think. But obviously, he's speaking something we could call modern English, whereas he would have had a hard time having a conversation with Chaucer. Real language change happens at a nice, noble, steady pace. You can see that having happened with the unwritten languages and what we can know about their pasts. It's much slower once a language is on writing, which is good in some ways because, of course, people need to have some one code that they can all use. But it's bad in other ways because it ends up helping along this illusion that language doesn't change.
Right.
Given that we don't see all that much change between the way we talk now and the way people talk in Fitzgerald's novels and stories, it's easy to think language doesn't really change, where if there were no writing, there'd be no question. Everybody would understand that the way your great-grandfather talked is weird and bygone and language is always morphing along. We end up protected from that reality.
It's interesting how it took you until the last pages of your book to get to like. You wanted to savor the one that's often hated by most till toward the end. And you say like is something that kind of demonstrates pretty much everything in the book.
Everything there. And so like is one of these face markers. It definitely conveys your personhood when you're speaking. Like starts out as a word that means body, and then it comes to mean similar. And now it's being used, especially by people under a certain age, as practically a filler. That's a marvelous process. And I mentioned that There's a random language that I happen to be reading a description of spoken in Borneo where there's some random little word that's sprinkled into casual utterances all the time. And I was thinking, boy, that's just like in English. And nobody would tell this group of people in Borneo, stop using that little word so much. You just think of it as just the flavor of the language. Here in English, it's the same thing. Like's usage is very complicated. Dissertations have been written. And yeah, it has a kind of a bubblegum smell. I think that it's one of those cases where people should be told that whether you like it or not, in a formal context, you need to pull back on the likes. But most of us spend very little time in formal context. And in terms of the way like is used in casual speech, if it's good for Borneo, it should be good for us.
Let me ask you this finally. What are you hearing in the language these days? What kinds of changes are going on that you're paying attention to now? You write in the book that all, as in I'm all, mm-hmm. you're all, that seems to be one that you're seeing. What are some of the changes you're seeing now?
Listen to women under about 35 and something they're doing to indicate emphasis. Something like, stop, not stop, stop, that It's something that you would listen right past, but it's become really common with women over the past several years. And it's becoming what a Martian linguist would call an exclamative particle. Somebody will say, move, whereas 10 years ago it would have been, move. Oddly enough, that is language change. I have noticed that happening. Next time you're watching Modern Family, listen to the young female characters on Modern Family if you want an example of this. For those of you who have been watching A Broad City, yeah. Both of the women on that show are big people, yeah, because they're exactly the age. That's language change. There's this new particle developing, which is that people use when they're excited or when they're upset. I'll bet you it'll be in the grammars in about 100 years of casual speech. As usual, the changes start with women, and that's a whole other subject.
Wow.
But I've heard that lately. I'll bet men are going to be saying, it's for you, in about 15 years, and it'll be a change. Nobody from a Fitzgerald-era novel would have recognized why anybody was doing that. It wasn't even happening 20 years ago. It's a new thing in the language. Now, in a couple of years, people are going to start noticing it and complaining. But
right.
I will be sitting there and thinking, no, this is how you get from one stage of a language to another. That's what I mean by language is always on the move.
John McWhorter, his book Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still, like literally, joined us from a studio in Columbia at Columbia University. John McWhorter, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. Emily Anderson is our intern, and today is her last day in the position. So thanks for all your help and best of luck. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard, and I'm Doug Fabrizio.